Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Bill Littlefield is off this week. Seattle, City of Rain, hears thunder way off in the distance. Ahead on Only a Game, abandoned Supersonics fans wistfully watch as Oklahoma City advances through the NBA playoffs. Also, Tim Kirkjian forecasts the unusually rainy MLB season and the story of how Teddy Roosevelt saved football. Also ahead, greyhound racing for fun, not for profit.
It's a dog thing. Dogs love to chase moving objects. It really is fun for the dogs.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given, in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. The NBA's conference finals are in full swing. In the East, the Miami Heat and Chicago Bulls have split the first two games, and the Dallas Mavericks and Oklahoma City Thunder series also stands at one game apiece. Here to discuss the penultimate round of the NBA's second season is NBA.com senior writer Steve Ashburner. Steve, welcome back to Only a Game.
Glad to be back, Karen.
The Oklahoma City Thunder strode into Dallas this week, dropped game one to the home team, but they stole game two. Is it too early to say that this is an upset in the making?
Well, yeah, it probably is too early to say that. I think that on both sides, the West and the East, we're looking at six and seven game series. You know, so 1-1 is a little bit outside the norm because the visiting team got a game and switched the home court advantage. But frankly, I think all four teams are capable of winning on the other courts. And so it's not a surprise that these would start out 1-1 and that we'll probably see a lot of a change in that home court advantage as it plays out.
Dirk Nowitzki had 48 points for the Mavericks on Tuesday. On Thursday, he had a mere 29. The national media have been praising Dirk's recent accomplishments, but on last week's show, a Dallas sports writer told us that he's been playing this way for the last 5 years. Do you think Dirk gets a raw deal sometimes?
Well, you know, he's in a position that other players find themselves in the NBA, and frankly, it's a position that LeBron James, maybe to a greater degree, felt he was in Cleveland. And that is a lone all-star with good but not great teammates trying to get all the way through, you know, the various types of rosters and player combinations that he'll face. And for Dirk to carry a Mavericks team that doesn't have a comparably skilled player, certainly not anyone at his peak right now, Jason Kidd is a Hall of Famer, but past his prime. You know, that's what LeBron had in Cleveland. It's, to a degree, what Derrick Rose has in Chicago. So, yeah, well, Dirk has a big load to carry. And if he's off on a given night, you know, that pretty much is the difference between what you saw in Game 1 and in Game 2 in that series.
Game 3 shifts to OKC today. I would bet the fans there will be rather excited and very monochromatic.
Yes, the whiteout or the blueout conditions that we've seen in these playoffs, it apparently has some impact. The players get into it. It bonds the fans and makes them a little more committed to being the home court advantage. And, you know, in Oklahoma City, they like to stand up until their team scores for the first time. So it's a little bit of a college rah-rah atmosphere for NBA teams. And in this professionally jaded world of the NBA big bucks, I think it's a pretty refreshing thing. Oklahoma City is a bright spot on the NBA landscape as one of the newer markets that the NBA has embraced, and they've embraced the NBA right on back.
In the East, Miami and Chicago are even at one game apiece, of course. Before Game 2, you asserted that the Heat needed its starters to step up. They did that, scoring 68 of the team's 85 points. Will the starters remain that productive?
Well, Miami is almost all starters. So, yeah, I think Miami is fine with that. They know that with three stars, they can generally get close to 75 or 80 points, and they just need a little bit of help when the other players are neglected by their opponent's defense to push them over for a winning total.
Given the way Miami was put together, is there a chance that their postseason success will ring hollow, even if the Heat do go all the way?
Well, I think for certain NBA fans, yes. You know, Miami has never really tried to pretend that, you know, they wanted to have a gradation of their talent levels. They're fine with three guys doing it, and I think that's runs counter to what a lot of people look for in terms of competitive balance and the best players being maybe sprinkled around the league as delegates of basketball, where the best should want to beat the best, not necessarily team up with the best.
Chicago probably wishes it had Game 2 back. Do you expect the Bulls to rebound figuratively and perhaps literally in Game 3 tomorrow in Miami?
That's a very good point, because rebounding was a big difference between those two games. Now, Chicago after Game 1, a lot of people walked away from that saying, I don't think the Bulls can play any better. Well, after Game 2, a lot of those same folks walked away saying, I don't think the Bulls can play any worse. They shot about 34%. They missed 10 free throws. They were 3 of 20 on three-pointers. If they get those averages just up to sort of modest to low NBA standards, they're fine. So, you know, yes, give Miami's defense a tremendous amount of credit, but Chicago just had a bad shooting night across the board, and that was a big part of their problem, too.
You've already said that both of these series will go long and be close, but do you want to guess who makes it through and who wins in the finals?
Sure, I've had to guess in other other formats. I have said Dallas because I guess I give the nod to the experience, the number of veterans, the players who've gone through these type of wars. On the East, I think Miami is best equipped to do this. I think that the star power, the fact that you don't need as much of a bench at this time of year because games are spread out with one or two or more days of rest in between, I think that does suit them. And if it comes down to two players who can get to the foul line with friendly whistles from the referees versus one player in Derrick Rose, I think LeBron James and Dwayne Wade and the Miami Heat are more likely to advance.
Steve Ashburner is a senior writer for NBA.com. He joined me on the line from Chicago. Steve, thanks for talking with me.
Oh, glad to do it. Anytime, Karen.
As the NBA's Western Conference Finals progress, it's been the best of times for fans in Oklahoma. But in Seattle, it's the worst of times. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports on the NBA's Tale of Two Cities.
The Seattle Supersonics went on a road trip in 2008 and never came back. That's when owner Clay Bennett moved the franchise, and the Oklahoma City Thunder were born. Seattle Times sports columnist Jerry Brewer says the Thunder's current success started when Seattle drafted future superstar Kevin Durant in 2007, and that makes this year's Western Conference Finals even harder on Sonics fans.
Once the team moved to Oklahoma City, they had Durant, they had Russell Westbrook, they had the foundation for a great basketball team. That team was going to be a winner, whether they were in Seattle, Oklahoma City, or Tahiti.
The reasons for the move were complex. Bennett, who bought the Supersonics in 2006, is from Oklahoma. Seattle's Key Arena was considered subpar by NBA standards, but there wasn't much public support for building a new facility. Attendance was down, but some observers say rumors about the team moving made things worse. And many reports mention how bad the Sonics were in their final few seasons, but in 2005, they had reached the second round of the NBA playoffs. Jason Reed directed Sonicsgate, a documentary about the team's departure. He says it's frustrating to watch the franchise's best season in years from more than 1,900 miles away.
People are upset, and the better the Thunder do, the more upset people get. So out of all this anger and frustration, you know, with the team moving, it's created a community and brought NBA basketball fans back together, and we're stronger than louder than ever. They aren't rooting for the Thunder, but they're watching and rooting against the Thunder.
Six-time NBA All-Star Sean Kemp spent the bulk of his career in Seattle and still lives there. In an interview last week on radio station KJR, Kemp said the Thunder offered him front-row seats to a first-round playoff game against Denver, an offer he swatted into the stands.
I don't think it'd be too smooth for the people around here to look up one day and see me sitting on that front row to Oklahoma Thunder. You know, the people back here deserve basketball. It was taken and robbed from these people in this area, so my loyalty remains in this area, man, for these people until they get a team back. I won't be sitting on anybody's front row until the Sonics is back in action.
But while Seattle may still be mourning the loss of its team, fans in Oklahoma City are ecstatic the NBA has come to town. Barry Trammell is a sports columnist for The Oklahoman.
99.7% of the seats were sold this season. You see the car flags flying all over the state, like it's the state of Alabama or something. It's really gone gaga. It's a statewide phenomenon over in Tulsa, the other big metropolitan area in the state, huge Thunder fans. So it's really taken Oklahoma by storm.
The Thunder's success has driven some Sonics fans to turn on one of Seattle's native sons. Thunder guard Nate Robinson grew up in Seattle and attended the University of Washington. But when Robinson tweeted that Oklahoma City fans are the best on the planet, he was heavily criticized in his hometown. That's when Seattle fans crossed the line in the eyes of Times columnist Jerry Brewer.
It got to the point where Nate Robinson's mother had to go on a local radio station and defend her son. Nate Robinson couldn't be more Seattle. He's got the city skyline tattooed on his back. He's got the area code 206 tattooed on his body as well. And why couldn't we give him the benefit of the doubt?
Royce Young runs the blog DailyThunder.com. Young says there is some bad blood between Seattle and OKC, but he and many other Thunder fans feel for the Sonics faithful.
I've never liked the fact that we had to take another city's team to have our own team. You know, I mean, we're all absolutely in love with this team. I can't imagine growing up with them and, you know, my future children falling in love with these players and stuff, and then 40 years from now, somebody taking it away.
There is a small grassroots movement working to bring the NBA back to Seattle, but even if it succeeds, the team's official history is long gone. The deal to move the franchise to OKC allowed the Thunder to retain all of the Sonics' history. That's 41 years of Seattle basketball, including three trips to the NBA Finals and the 1979 NBA title. But Young says most Thunder fans would have preferred a clean start.
We don't care about downtown Freddie Brown or Gary Payton or Sean Kemp. And, I mean, I'm sure that breaks a lot of Seattle people's hearts. But, I mean, that wasn't our team. You know, that wasn't our franchise. Our franchise started in 2008 with Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook and those guys. So
I dare you to say that to Xavier McDaniel's face.
I definitely wouldn't say that to the X-Man.
Depending on how you see it, tonight's game against the Dallas Mavericks at the Ford Center in Oklahoma City is the Thunder's first home game in the Western Conference Finals, or their first since 1996. Either way, it's Game 3. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
And the Thunder rolls. The Thunder rolls. And the lightning strikes. Another love grows cold. On a sleepless night, as the storm blows all out of control, deep in her heart, the thunder rolls.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. In 2003, former professional soccer goalie Lloyd Scott ran the world's slowest marathon in a deep-sea diving suit to raise money for charity. In 2006, he raised 1.8 million pounds by completing the London Marathon while wearing a suit of armor and dragging a 300-pound dragon. This year, Lloyd Scott crawled the 26.2 miles of the London Marathon inside a giant costume of Brian the Snail from the children's TV show Magic Roundabout. It took 8 hours a day for 26 days, and he suffered near constant nosebleeds, vomiting, and cramps. But thus far, Mr. Scott's efforts have only raised 20,000 pounds for kids with mobility issues. What? Doesn't anyone love snails?
I want to thank you for putting me back in my snail shell.
I'm Karen Given, filling in for Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, how Theodore Roosevelt would have solved the current NFL labor impasse. But first...
You saw Lance Armstrong inject EPO.
Yeah, like we all did. Like I did many, many times.
In an interview that will air on 60 Minutes tomorrow, Tyler Hamilton says he saw teammate Lance Armstrong inject the blood booster EPO during his first Tour de France win in 1999 and while training for the event in 2000 and 2001. Hamilton went on to win a gold medal at the 2004 Olympics before failing doping controls on two separate occasions and retiring from the sport in 2009. Yesterday, the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency revealed that Hamilton had already returned his gold medal. Hamilton's admission and his testimony in front of a grand jury last summer will likely impact the federal case against Lance Armstrong. Armstrong has yet to be charged, and Thursday night he tweeted, quote, 20-plus year career, 500 drug controls worldwide, in and out of competition, never a failed test, I rest my case. It wasn't the federal case against Lance Armstrong we had expected to be discussing today. Prosecutors in the perjury trial against Barry Bonds were scheduled to tell a judge yesterday whether they wanted to retry Bonds after a jury deadlocked on three of the charges against him. That hearing has been rescheduled for June 17th, which means we're free to talk to ESPN's Tim Kirkchin about the rest of the baseball news. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Karen. Nice to be back.
It's not even Memorial Day yet, and Major League Baseball has already had more games rained out than it did in all of last season. Are we going to be hearing Let's Play 2 a lot this summer?
We certainly are, and there are some teams that will be happy about that because they will get a primetime, really warm weather summer game as opposed to a game that was going to be played in lousy weather in April where not many people were going to show up, and in theory during the summer a lot more people are going to show up. However, the players, the managers, they're not going to be happy about playing two games in July as opposed to one in April and one in July because doubleheaders are really, really hard. It takes all day at the ballpark, and teams don't play the normal traditional doubleheaders anymore. One admission stay for two games. They have what we call split doubleheaders. So you play a game at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, you take a few hours off, and then play a 7 o'clock game, which means the teams, the players in uniform are there at, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning, and they usually leave the ballpark at about midnight or one in the morning. That's a pretty long day, and they just assume not do that.
The Cleveland Indians have one of the best records in baseball and are in first place in the AL Central. What gives?
The Indians are a very surprising team, Karen. Let me tell you how surprising. I saw 29 out of 30 teams in spring training. The only team I missed was the Indians, thinking, well, they're not going to contend anyway. I don't think that was a very good call. The Indians have a bunch of scrappers on their offensive end who really grind out at bats. Their young starting pitching is way better than I thought it was going to be. Their bullpen has been pieced together, and it is very strong. And it's a great story because, you know, something good needs to happen in Cleveland these days. And eventually those Indian fans are going to start to show up in bigger quantities than they have lately. But it's a really good story. And with the way the Twins have played, that is poorly, the way the Tigers have shown some holes that I didn't think they had, and the way that the White Sox overall have struggled, I think the Indians are in this for the long haul, and I would have never guessed that a month ago.
For decades, the Chicago Cubs and the Boston Red Sox were baseball's lovable losers. The Sox reversed their curse. The Cubs is going on 103 years. This weekend, they're playing their first series at Fenway Park since the 1918 World Series. Any chance this will help the Cubbies' karma?
Well, we have to hope so. I mean, but this is why interleague play still works for me. I mean, it is an idea that still needs tweaking. It certainly isn't as great as it was 15 years ago, but the Cubs visiting the Red Sox for the first time since the 1918 World Series is a great story. It's better than the Cubs visiting the Pirates. It's not a perfect system, but I'll be at the Sunday game between the Cubs and the Red Sox, and I can't wait to go.
Tim, Hall of Famer Harmon Killebrew died Tuesday after suffering from esophageal cancer. Killebrew spent the bulk of his 22-year career with the Minnesota Twins. He had 573 career home runs and was the 1969 American League MVP. Where does he rank among the all-time greats?
Well, he was one of the great power hitters of his era. He hit 573 home runs, and when he retired, he was in the top five of all time, and only Babe Ruth hit more home runs in the history of the American League than Harmon Killebrew. He hit 40 homers in a season 8 times. He led the league in homers 6 times. He made the All-Star team at 3 different positions. He made 13 All-Star teams. And he was just a great ambassador for the game when he played and after he retired. I can tell you I've met almost all the living Hall of Famers and most of the Hall of Famers of the last 30 years. And it's Brooks Robinson, Stan Musial, and Harmon Killebrew as the nicest, most gentlemanly Hall of Famers I've ever met, and he will be missed, to be sure.
Killebrew's nickname was Killer, and as you say, he was widely regarded as one of the nicest guys in the game. What's your lasting memory of Harmon Killebrew?
Well, it's my last memory, and that was sitting with him on the bench at spring training 2 springs ago, and it was just he and I, we were sitting there looking out at the field, watching the Twins get ready for an exhibition game. And Harmon Killebrew was so charitable and so helpful to today's players, as instead of being some bitter old guy who said, oh, these guys all did steroids, or oh, they all made way more money than I did. Instead, he was complimentary of them. And I finally tried to pull out something from his career about how great he was, and he was so humble, he was not going there. But finally, he looked at me and he said, well, I was pretty strong, you know. And I said, yes, Harmon, I remember how strong you were, one of the strongest players ever to play the game.
Tim Kirkshin appears on ESPN's Baseball Tonight and joins us regularly on Only a Game. Tim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Karen.
This week, a ruling by an appeals court in St. Louis brought the NFL players and owners back to the bargaining table, offering hope to beleaguered fans. And then just a few minutes before midnight last night, the players who sued the league for antitrust violations filed a court brief accusing the NFL of acting like a cartel. Maybe not the most hopeful sign. But there was a time when the future of the game was much more precarious than it is today. In the early 1900s, universities were dropping the sport due to injuries and deaths. State legislators were considering banning it, and it took an act of the sitting president of the United States to bring about change. John J. Miller tells the story in his new book, The Big Scrum, How Teddy Roosevelt Saved Football. And he joins me from NPR in Washington. Mr. Miller, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
In 1905, the game of football didn't look much like the modern version. How was the game played, and why did so many people want to ban it?
In 1905, 18 people died playing football. They were on the big-time college level all the way down to the sandlot level. They were dropping dead back in those days, and that's because, in large measure, the sport was different from how it is now. It was a lot more like rugby back in the early days. Think of it as a series of goal line stands on the 50-yard line over and over and over again, big men crashing into each other, forming piles. The problem was severe enough that a prohibition movement rose up. A group of people led by the president of Harvard University, who was Charles W. Eliot at the time, The Nation magazine, muckraking journalists, they said it was a blood sport. They compared it to gladiatorial combat in the Roman amphitheater. They said, there's no place for this in modern American life. We must prohibit the sport. So they crusaded against it, and it took Theodore Roosevelt to save the game.
So let's get to that. Theodore Roosevelt was arguably football's most influential supporter, and Harvard President Charles Eliot was one of football's greatest detractors. They were both proponents of a movement called Muscular Christianity. What was Muscular Christianity?
So in the middle of the 19th century, a lot of Americans were concerned about the fitness of their country. Were people getting enough exercise? People were moving from the countryside into the city. They were taking jobs in factories. Life, in a lot of ways, was becoming more sedentary in the middle of the 19th century, people said, we've got to do something about this. And so a social and religious movement rose up called Muscular Christianity that says, to be a good Christian, you need to take care of not only your soul, but also your body. And the most obvious manifestation of it that we still know about today is the YMCA movement. And this was an aspect of muscular Christianity. This is sort of the social, political, and religious context into which these games are born.
So how did Roosevelt and Eliot come to interpret this muscular Christianity so differently?
Well, Roosevelt attended Harvard University, and in 1876, as an 18-year-old freshman, he watched his first football game. He and a bunch of friends got on a train in Cambridge and went down to New Haven. They watched the second ever football game played between Harvard and Yale. He thinks this is great entertainment. It's great fun to watch. Over time, he becomes convinced that football and rough sports like it are socially useful. They're socially useful because they help turn boys into men, and they help make them into men who can lead America forward into a new century. And he becomes such an advocate of this idea that when he recruits the Rough Riders, we all know the story. He goes out to San Antonio and wants to recruit a bunch of cowboys and Westerners to be in this unit that's going to fight with him in Cuba. And that's basically true. But if you read his memoirs, he also says he wants football players. And he signs them up. They go to Cuba with him. So he saw football as not just a piece of mere entertainment, but actually a social good. Charles Eliot, on the other hand, most important man in the history of higher education in the United States. He's the one who made Harvard a great school. He was president for 40 years, longer than anybody before or since. He believed in physical fitness. He believed in exercise. He engaged in a lot of it himself. But he did not like football. He did not like the violence. He thought it was an ungentlemanly sport and had no place in modern American life. So he and Roosevelt started butting heads.
Well, what I love about his objections to the sport are so crazy. He equated coaching from the sidelines with cheating, and he thought that feigning a pass was somehow immoral. Have I got that right?
Yeah, it is. It's funny to read him today on this. He didn't like baseball either. He thought if a pitcher threw a curveball, he was engaging in an act of deception, and that's something that gentlemen shouldn't do. He also thought that games that required umpires and referees were unfit for gentlemen, because gentlemen shouldn't require these kinds of arbiters on the field. They should be able to settle their own differences and be sportsmanlike and so on. And it sounds crazy today, but you got to recognize that these sports were just being born back then, and you know, they were making up the rules as they went along, and these were some attitudes that Eliot brought to the sport. Now, when he starts criticizing football's brutality, you got to confess that he kind of has a point. People are getting hurt, some are dying, and he wanted to do something about that.
So Harvard banned football in 1885, but the sport was brought back just a year later when the athletic committee ruled that the game of football has been much improved during the past season. The game hadn't been improved at all, so why did Harvard bring it back?
Well, the sport was becoming more and more popular. Students loved it. Alumni loved it. It was popular in the press. Sports sections and newspapers were being born at this time, and they loved to cover football, you know, then as they do now. And alumni pressure forced the game to come back after a one-year hiatus at Harvard. And there was some concern that Harvard was not keeping up with Yale and Princeton, which never did abandon the sport. And there were also people who said, well, you know, the reason Harvard gave it up is because Yale was actually beating them year after year. So people were poked fun at Harvard for having given it up. But they were only gone for a year, and then they came back and kept on playing. But the violence continued.
My guest is John J. Miller, author of The Big Scrum. You're listening to Only a Game. So President Roosevelt's agenda in the summer and fall of 1905 went something like this: negotiate a peace accord between Japan and Russia, and then get the top men in football together and save the game.
Exactly.
Did Roosevelt really do anything more than say, gentlemen, fix this?
That is what he did, but of course it mattered a lot. In October of 1905, Roosevelt summons to the White House the head coaches from Harvard, Yale, and Princeton, the three biggest and most important college football programs. But Roosevelt didn't issue any orders. He didn't tell them what to do, but he said something has to be done. And so they passed a series of sweeping rule changes, the most important of which is the development of the forward pass. And in doing so, they began to address the violence problem, number one. And number two, they created football as a distinctively American sport. This was the moment when it really separated itself from its origins as a rugby game. And of course, it wanted to become what is today by far the most popular sport in the United States.
Even with these rules, football will never be entirely safe. I suspect that Teddy Roosevelt would be pleased about that.
Roosevelt understood that it was a rough sport. He also understood that there's no such thing as a risk-free activity. He believed that rough sports like football were good for boys, taught them how to deal with adversity, thought a boy getting banged up on a football field and feeling a little sore the next day was probably good for his character. And he thought it helped turn them into great Americans who could lead the country forward.
I really can't resist a what if here. If Roosevelt was alive and president today, what would he say to the NFL owners and players to resolve the current labor impasse?
That's a great question. What we know now about Roosevelt and what he did in 1905 shows that a skillful leader with a deft touch can solve a vexing problem. And, you know, I would welcome the president today taking a couple hours out of his day and solving the lockout. That would be a great use of his time. I don't know that it could be done, but Roosevelt took on a very serious problem back in 1905, and through his intervention, the sport came up with a solution.
John J. Miller's new book, The Big Scrum, is published by Harper. He joined me from NPR in Washington. John, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks very much.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose summer school has courses for high school, college, and adults to earn academic credit and experience campus life. summer.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
The Surfing Madonna of Encinitas must go. The 10-by-10-foot stained glass mosaic of Our Lady of Guadalupe on a surfboard appeared overnight under a train bridge in Encinitas, California. The mosaic has plenty of admirers, some of whom have said the artwork is gorgeous, uplifting, and a random act of kindness. But the city says the lady must go. City officials don't object to the Madonna's long flowing gown or to her hands in prayer. They don't even object to the words "Save the Ocean" spelled out in blue letters to her left. No, the city doesn't object to anything about the lady, except that she was erected without a public review process. Luckily, some local business people have less stringent review processes. They're hoping to give her a new home on private property. I'm Karen Given, filling in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, greyhounds who race for sheer joy and belly rubs. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's sports news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The Boston Bruins face the Tampa Bay Lightning in Game 4 of the Eastern Conference Finals this afternoon in Tampa. The Bruins lead that series 2-1. Is it too early to say that the Cup is coming home?
Yeah, because I think Tampa put a lot of rubber on Tim Thomas in Game 3. Thomas was tremendous. The best way he plays, which is to wander outside the crease a little bit and cut angles down. If the Bruins give up as many shots on him, especially power play shots, as they did in Game 2, we're going to be tied up coming back to Boston.
Meanwhile, the Vancouver Canucks fans are getting excited about the possibility of their team making it to the Stanley Cup Finals for the first time since 1994. Is it fair to say that at least one fan has gotten just a bit too excited about the prospect?
Yes, a young lady flashed her upper torso
at Ben Eager, who was the San Jose Sharks forward, who was in the penalty box at the time and was actually picked up by the CBC.
Oops.
Ben Eager apparently did not notice the young lady, which belies his last name when you come right down to it, since half of Canada did.
On Thursday, the Atlanta Thrashers will host a Select a Seat rally for season ticket holders in Atlanta. And I point out that the rally is in Atlanta because, according to the Toronto Globe and Mail, the Thrashers are moving to Winnipeg.
Yeah, so you can have a seat in Atlanta. You won't see any hockey, but you'll have a very comfortable seat. I think moving hockey back to Winnipeg is a terrific story, and I hope it happens.
Each team in the NBA Conference Finals has won one game, Charlie. So, of course, I'm going to ask you which team is looking like a winner.
I think the Chicago Bulls are looking like a winner at this point, even though that they did lose the second game to Miami. They did everything that the Celtics found themselves incapable of doing against Miami. So if you ask me which team looks more like a winner, it's probably the Bulls.
And what about the Western Conference Finals?
I think they're going to be enormously entertaining. They already have been. I love the Oklahoma City Thunder. I love the way that team plays, and I think they're ready to step up.
On Tuesday night, the Cleveland Cavaliers sent the 14-year-old son of team owner Dan Gilbert to the NBA draft lottery. Nick, who suffers from neurofibromatosis, looked on as the Cavs were awarded this year's number one pick. But Timberwolves president David Kahn, whose team picks second, apparently didn't consider that a feel-good story.
Well, he apparently told a joke that misfired about the league picking, good heartwarming stories and essentially rigging the lottery. He will be getting a phone call from Mr. Stern. It wasn't a very funny joke. It certainly wasn't as funny as the way Minnesota's drafted the last few years.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is unhappy, Charlie. See, there are five statues outside the Staples Center where the Lakers play, and none honor him. Do you agree that the Lakers have slighted their Hall of Famer?
Well, considering that among the statues are Chick Hearn, an announcer, and Wayne Gretzky, a hockey player, and Oscar De La Hoya, a fighter, yeah, I would say so. But I think he's going to get around to getting a statue. He certainly seems more offended about it than I would thought he would.
Former Minnesota Twins slugger Harmon Killebrew died Tuesday morning. He was 74 years old. Killebrew played for 22 years in the majors, hit 573 home runs, and was by all accounts a good guy. Do you have a remembrance to offer?
The one thing I remember about him is that he tied Carl Yastrzemski for the home run title the year Carl Yastrzemski won the Triple Crown in 1967, leading the Red Sox to that improbable pennant. In which they, by the way, they beat Minnesota with Harmon Killebrew the last 2 days of the season. One of my friends in Minneapolis emailed me this week and said that Harmon Killebrew was the guy everybody thought Kirby Puckett was.
For the first time in 93 years, the Chicago Cubs are playing the Boston Red Sox at Fenway Park. I take it you don't agree with those who suggest that the timing is just a little bit frightening.
No, I like the fact that the Cubs are coming here, and I don't think it has anything to do with the Family Radio Network or whatever it is saying that the Rapture is going to happen. So, no, I don't think two things are connected at all, which doesn't mean I'm not laying in canned food and buying a shortwave radio.
Bobby Bonilla hasn't played for the Mets since 1999. His tenure with the team was rocky, to put things politely. So why will the Mets soon start paying Bonilla $1.2 million a year for the next 25 years?
Because he signed, and you think Bernie Madoff was a fraud. Bobby Bonilla signed a contract deferring the money. He's going to start collecting seven-figure checks this July, and it runs through 2035.
Wow. The NFL says progress has been made in talks with the players. The two sides met briefly this week and are scheduled to meet again on June 7th. So praise hallelujah or shut up already.
Oh, no. I mean, progress is being made in the fact that they both got in the same room together. And that's pretty much the progress that was made.
College football conference commissioners are weighing in on a suggestion that student athletes should be paid more than the scholarship money awarded now, and that the compensation should be raised to reflect, quote, the full cost of attendance. Is this a good idea?
This is hilarious. This is once again the people running college sports trying to figure out a way to pay the athletes without saying, we're paying the athletes. Guess what? If you increase their compensation over and above their scholarships, you're paying the athletes. Just say you're paying the athletes.
Tyler Hamilton, who won an Olympic gold medal in cycling at the 2004 Olympics, said this week that he saw former teammate Lance Armstrong inject EPO on several occasions. Will his accusations have an impact on the legal case the federal government is mounting against Armstrong?
Well, I would suspect it would. Of course, Tyler has written a letter which he saw fit to release to the media, I would point out, to Lance Armstrong, in which Tyler spends an awful lot of time driving the nails through his own palms. So I have a feeling this has a lot to do with Tyler trying to come back as kind of the whistleblowing hero of this whole thing, but I do think it will materially affect the investigation into Armstrong.
Charlie, you had a little trouble 2 weeks back when Bill asked you to pick a winner in the Kentucky
Derby.
Only
because my horse didn't win.
But according to an article I have in front of me, betting this year's Preakness is really easy.
Yes.
So what's your super easy pick?
My super easy pick is not to pick Dialed In, who won the Derby. I think Animal Kingdom will probably win. But I also like a horse called Midnight Interlude, which won the Santa Anita Derby, which I actually saw on TV because I was channel surfing and and I had already seen that night's version of River Monsters. So I think Bob Baffert's a good trainer. He's coming in 15-1. You want to make a little money, bet on him.
And finally, Charlie, an anonymous bettor from Glasgow, Scotland, won a lot of money with something called a 50 pence each way accumulator. I don't know what that is, but I'm thinking I ought to try it.
I think it's something you buy at a convenience store. No, he bet £1 and won £350,000. First of all, he thought he was going to win only £21,000. He had to have his son come in and do the actual math. And he says he's going to buy his own home and he's going to go visit his sisters overseas.
Aww.
Isn't that nice?
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America and several other books. He joins Bill Littlefield each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen. Big money. I like it. Big watch, big chain, nice clothes, nice car. Big money. I like it. We do it like
years ago, there were more than 60 Greyhound racetracks across the country. Now, there are fewer than 25. Some tracks closed when states like Massachusetts banned the practice. But even more are closing as Greyhound racing becomes less popular and gamblers take their dollars to casinos and online betting parlors. But Greyhounds are more popular than ever. According to the American Greyhound Council, nearly 300,000 have been adopted by people like Abigail Baker. Over the years, Abigail has given a home to five former track dogs, and they all have loved to show her what they can do.
Listen, lady, you look nice. Put me in that box.
No, Bob, you cannot get in.
When Abigail talks to her Greyhound Patterman, she vocalizes both sides of the conversation. But even for those less well-versed in dog speak, it's clear that Patterman wants something as he whines and paws longingly at the starting box for an amateur Greyhound race.
Well, I know it's going to be fun. This is fun. This is the start of fun. If I get in here, the fun will start. No, honey.
After spending their early years racing at a Greyhound track, 10-year-old Patterman and Abigail's other elderly Greyhound, Olivia, are too old to race, even as amateurs. But like most Greyhounds, Abigail says they're still itching to run.
That's what they want to do. They want to get out there and sprint. And then they want to do a big figure eight. So I believe that they like to run by me to say, hey, look at me, we're really fast.
When running circles isn't enough, Abigail brings her Greyhounds to Legra events like this one on a privately owned grass runway in southern New Hampshire. The large Gazehound Racing Association was formed to give Greyhounds a place to race for the sheer joy of it and has expanded to include divisions for other breeds. Older dogs like Patterman and Olivia are allowed to run for short distances during lunchtime practice breaks. And even little Basenjis, who look nothing like their quick and powerful cousins, get in on the fun. Waiting at the finish line are loving owners who offer the same praise and belly rubs for the last place finisher as they do for the dog who came in first. Abigail freely admits that her love of the sport has become a bit evangelical.
And I do feel sorry for the people who adopt Greyhounds, and they never do this. They never let their dog go out and do the thing that it wants to do the most. And so I'm always glad when I meet somebody and letting somebody with sighthounds, with a deerhound or a wolfhound know, hey, you could come join us and your dog could do what he was bred to do.
Roll call, Charm.
Kate Bender, race secretary for the Granite State Greyhounds, calls today's racers to inspection. Kate carefully checks the gait of each dog and looks for any sign of injury. Some, especially the Basenjis, aren't so sure about running on the wet grass.
Conjo is easier.
Come on, buddy.
Okay, he looks good.
Kate's greyhounds are resting at home after running races yesterday. But she says even those dogs who don't look enthusiastic about today's damp conditions are thrilled when it comes time to race.
Oh, yeah. It's what they're made to do. I mean, when I start getting my stuff up out of the basement before a weekend of racing, they know. They know we're going. And they start getting excited every time I shift down my chair from then until it's actually time to get in the van and drive to the racing field. They're at the door. Can we go now, Mom? Can we go? Are we going racing? They love it.
Even when Kate didn't own a dog who could race competitively, she gave her weekends over to acting as race secretary for the Granite State Greyhounds. Racing proponents drive hundreds of miles to give their dogs a chance to run down the 200-yard grass track. After so much effort has been put into banning professional greyhound racing, Kate admits that amateur dog racing is not without controversy. Dogs, especially those who aren't conditioned properly, sometimes get hurt. But in her opinion, those who object just don't understand greyhounds.
Greyhounds are not rescued from having to race. It is true that the racing industry has problems, but having the greyhounds running is not one of them. Do you let your kids play soccer? Or, God help us, hockey? It's risky and they can be injured, but it's what they want to do.
Between the excited dogs and the slightly eccentric owners, Allegra event is carefully controlled chaos. In the first race of the day, Phoenix, a beautiful snowy white Saluki, will race against herself. No other Salukis came out to race today.
In you go.
The metal starting box looks and sounds impossibly scary, but Phoenix goes in without any trouble. Kate runs to the front of the box and shakes the lure, a plush squeaky toy on a long rope, and then runs behind the box, which will spring open the second the lure starts to move. Phoenix bolts from the starting box. Her graceful body glides down the 200-yard course in just a few seconds. I know that dogs can't really smile, but as I watch her fly past, I can't shake the feeling that Phoenix is grinning from ear to ear.
Hi, Tootsie Roll. I believe this is our only greyhound today, Donna.
That's what I just said to Anita. She has hope. She's going to be everybody today.
Donna Collins adopted Toots from the Wonderland racetrack in 2007. Donna says she was calm, loving, and in peak condition. She's also slow. At most Legra events, Toots wins the Turtle, the award given to the slowest dog of the day. It's a distinction that doesn't bother Toots or her owner in the slightest.
She doesn't care because she has actually figured out, if you watch her at the end, she's figured out that if she slows down by near the end, she can be the first dog on the lure, and that's what she wants.
She went over.
Oh, I know, baby.
She was the first one, so when it stopped,
Deb, we have an anxious pup here.
In between the real races, the club trains the next generation of greyhound racers. Unlike the rescue dogs, these one-year-old puppies will never see the inside of a professional greyhound racetrack. And while running comes naturally, walking into a metal box at the starting line does not.
Oh, it's fine.
You want me to hold that?
It's fine.
To make the transition easier, dogs are first taught to run straight through the box without closing the gates on either side. For this young greyhound, the discomfort of the box is quickly left behind as she sprints down the field.
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, she's awesome.
April showers are supposed to bring May flowers, but this spring, they've brought more rain. Kate Hare and her husband drove up from Downingtown, Pennsylvania, to let their Irish deerhounds try racing for the first time. Kate doesn't really get the chance to watch. She spends her dog's practice run hiding behind a yellow airplane parked on the side of the runway. When she emerges, Kate eyes the overcast skies and wonders if she should be wearing her raincoat.
If it was pouring rain, everybody would still be out here doing this as long as the footing was safe.
Wow.
So, yes,
I'm glad it's not.
And everybody still stays till the very end and has lunch and continues on and has a good time, whether it rains or not. And here we go.
And with that, the skies open up. For the next 2 hours, the humans get drenched while the dogs happily bound down the racetrack in the rain. Michelle Houghton, president of the Granite State Greyhounds, says a little discomfort on her part is worth the joy this event brings to her dogs.
And they don't care if it's raining. Certainly mine don't, anyway. They don't care if it's raining. They wouldn't care if it's snowing. They don't care.
Yeah.
They just want to run.
At the end of the day, there are no betting slips to settle up. Just blue ribbons for the winners and gag gifts for the turtle. The dogs are settled in their beds in warm, dry cars, while their owners cheer for each and every competitor, even the ones that didn't finish and the ones who had no one to compete against except themselves.
Toots, of course.
Yes.
The Granite State Greyhounds wouldn't have it any other way.
I would also, however, like to acknowledge Charm, who ran very nicely today.
Yay, Charm.
So Basenji's, yay, Basenji's!
Yay, intrepid Basenji's!
Game is produced by Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Allison Gluck. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view my Greyhound photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Abigail Baker, who draws a parallel between dog racing and the world's oldest profession.
We like sex. We don't necessarily want to have to do it when somebody else tells us to, but yeah, we'd like it.
Yeah, no comment. I'm Karen Given. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting Games for Health, working to use video games to improve health at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.